We are going to start the show with a few sounds of this week.
I've just received a call from Secretary Clinton. She congratulated us, it's about us, on our victory.
Being your candidate has been one of the greatest honors of my life.
The peaceful transition of power is one of the hallmarks of our democracy. And over the next few months, we are going to show that to the world.
And over the next hour, plus the coming weeks and months, we'll look at President-elect Trump's policies and what we know about them. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. There are many places where potential Trump policy will touch all of our lives. We can't get through all of them today, but we're devoting most of this show to examining them with our fantastic Marketplace team and guests. We also want you to reach out to us, so come talk at marketplace.org, on our Facebook page, or on Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. We will start the show with a special post-election version of our segment Long and Short. That's when we borrow terms from the world of finance and ask our guests to go long, that is, bet on, or short, and bet against, topics in the news. This week, we have Gillian White, a senior associate editor at The Atlantic, and Joe Wiesenthal, host of What'd You Miss on Bloomberg TV. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
I'm excited to kick these things around with you guys because you are both so thoughtful about economics, the election, where all of these things intersect. Gillian, I want you to start. In this post-election world, what are you long?
Yeah, so I think one of the things that a lot of us have seen if you're looking at the market in post-Trump land is that Trump trades have done really well. And among the things that have done really well that are Trump-related are coal stocks. You know, one of the things that Trump said during his campaign was that one of his first plans, if he was elected, was that he was going to reverse many of President Obama's energy policies. What Trump wants to do instead is kind of double down on domestic energy, on oil, on fossil fuels, and what people have termed clean coal. So clean coal is a little bit of a misnomer, but essentially it is a process by which coal is still used for energy, but it goes through a process where it releases less carbon dioxide, fewer greenhouse gases, but it's still not clean. It's still problematic for the environment. Lots of environmentalists and environment experts have said that it helps a little, but it still puts us in the same place.
But how do you pull a long position out of this?
Yeah, I mean, I just think that clean coal and clean coal-related corporations are just going to do well. Everything that Trump has said that he will boost and put money behind and put effort behind has done really well in the stock market this week. Even if you don't believe that clean coal is an actual thing, betting on it might be a good bet right now.
I am really sort of fascinated by the energy question, in part because a lot of the people who don't like the direction where we've gone with energy seem to be complaining about private sector innovation and changes that are kind of passing by policy. I mean, coal has obviously been on the decline for a while, and they ascribe to it political reasons for it, when in fact we have more abundant, cheaper alternatives. Natural gas is one. Solar has got getting extraordinarily cheap. Solar, it's weird because solar is so politically loaded as a concept. Mm-hmm. I think maybe at one point people just associated it with like hippies and they thought it could only survive with like incredible subsidies.
Well, and sort of the Solyndra story got
folded
into
but
that.
It's just the pace of collapse of solar prices and the cheapness of energy coming from solar is really surpassing the political story here. And so it feels like a lot of these people who sort of like romanticize coal are, you know, it's kind of like everything else with this, are romanticizing something that is not so easily brought back just with policy changes.
Joe, I'm actually going to bring up your short because I think it sticks with this market-centric way of looking at a Trump presidency. Those two dovetail kind of nicely. Tell us about your short.
Well, we've had this extraordinary era of very low interest rates and low inflation. And we've had this sort of all within this economic regime since the late 80s, which is sort of, you know, fiscal discipline. And I think it's possible that we're going to see a sort of serious change on the fiscal front. We have a president-elect who has promised major tax cuts, who has promised all kinds of bridges and hospitals and schools or anything. And we have a Republican Party that I would be very surprised if they do anything to hold his feet to the fire or stick to their previous beliefs about fiscal conservatism. And this is a situation we just haven't had in a long time. And you're already seeing it reflect in the bond market and interest rates. Yield on the 10-year Treasury has surged above 2% in the wake of the election. People are expecting a various serious fiscal boost.
I think it's really interesting to watch what happens in the first, well, I guess towards the end of this year and then entering 2017 when it comes to the Fed and policy. I would agree with Joe that, you know, I think the conversation surrounding what to do with rates has focused a lot on the fact that, you know, we were pushing towards full employment, low unemployment for years, and seemingly we are there. But I think there's still a lot of question around what exactly full employment would look like for everyone. And the Fed,
because there are
saying,
so many people who are underemployed as well.
Right, exactly. So I think we have some of these weird conversations that are happening. And also we have, you know, low labor force participation that it seems like no one quite knows what to do with or how to explain away. But yeah, I mean, they were talking about raising rates as soon as December. So I do wonder what happens now under a Trump presidency, how quickly things change and in what direction they go.
I want to spin to both of your other positions because they take us sort of from the realm of economic to the social and how we communicate with one another. Jillian, tell me about your short.
Yeah. So, Joe, I think you might have something to say on this, too. I'm short on Facebook. I think that prior to the election, and especially in the wake of it, people are thinking a lot about how they communicate, how they get news, how they participate in their communities. And Facebook has somewhere around 2 billion users. It is huge in terms of the way we communicate our thoughts and our beliefs, political or otherwise. And Neiman Lab had a really interesting piece this week on why the media was so wrong about Trump and was so wrong about this election. And there are a wide array of theories. But a lot of people are talking about Facebook and the fact that it kind of, the algorithm as it stands, kind of first reinforces the beliefs and opinions that people already hold, but also that it promotes what Neiman Lab called a sewer of misinformation.
So many pieces of fake news.
Exactly. So many things that just are not factually true or from accurate or reliable sources, and those things got promoted in a crazy way. And I think it's really going to make people think and wonder about the platform that they're using to gather all of their information and to make what they think or assume are fact-based opinions.
I think Jillian is completely correct. You know, we talk a lot about filter bubbles and people only getting information that confirms their beliefs, and I certainly think that's a problem, and I think that obviously fake news is probably indefensible by any objective measure.
But I think we're three journalists who think fake news
right.
is bad.
But I think there's another factor here that is also really important, which is the sort of reconceptualization of identity in the world of social media. And by that, I mean maybe 20 years ago, someone in Milwaukee might have seen themselves like, oh, I'm an Irish American and I'm an accountant and I'm a Packers fan. Now they might think of themselves like, oh, I'm a white man and I'm under threat and I identify with other whites under threat in Europe when I read about immigration and I sympathize with Vladimir Putin and stuff like that. That may be an exaggeration, but I think that this is a really big deal, which is that the idea being like people create new ways of thinking about themselves based on the information that they get. And in a broadcast or a print world in which there's sort of one national community, I think there's some pretty startling sort of fragmentations of the nation itself that's being caused by social media.
Yeah.
Do companies then that act in many ways as unofficial gatekeepers of information, do they have a responsibility to address this? Or do we say, you know what, one of the tenets of this country is the First Amendment and people can say what they want to say?
I mean, my first thought on the fake news thing, it's definitely should be a serious problem that they address. I think on the bigger questions of how social media sort of realigns society, I'm not all that optimistic that there's any obvious way that, and some of it's for the better. I mean, not all of it's bad or anything. I just think that like there's some new like divisions and new organizations within society that some for better, some for worse are going to change our democracy.
Yeah. And I also think a lot of what happens with these private companies and how they get involved and disseminate this information has a lot to do with how we as users choose to accept or reject these platforms.
Joe, we're going to go from a modern type of community to, I guess, what, the oldest community in the book? Tell me you're long.
Yeah, I don't really know exactly how to go long this from a trade perspective, but I have this theory that there's going to be an uptick in religious participation in U.S. life, because I think we live in a time in which people feel that the institutions that are durable, that they assumed would be timely, are not as solid as perhaps they thought. And I could see people from all political ideologies and different walks of life finding comfort and stability in religion, and so wanting to go back to churches and synagogues and mosques as a way to connect with something that feels timeless, that doesn't feel like it's wildly under flux, that feels like a shelter from an uncertain moment.
So I actually am totally on board with this long. I would say that in the past week, at least 4 to 5 people who I've known for over 5 years, who I've never heard bring up religion or any type of higher belief system in any capacity, were talking about going to actual places of organized religion and kind of relying on a higher power to move forward. I was a little shocked, but I think that's completely right. When you know, things kind of get out of hand or are so shocking, people try to rely on some way to explain them away or to, you know, think about how things can be better in the future or whatever it might be. But yeah, I would agree with that. I think people are definitely going long religion right now.
Jillian White from The Atlantic, Joe Weisenthal from Bloomberg, thank you both very much.
Thank you. That was great.
Thanks, Lizzie.
There's more Marketplace Weekend just ahead. You already know we are all about the numbers here at Marketplace, and an election brings with it a lot of numbers. Our By the Numbers blog follows the biggest and most important ones every day, so here are our producers Tony Wagner and Cerise Castle with this week's election news by the numbers. Lead us off, Tony.
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number is
15 million.
That's how many jobs the U.S. economy has added since the recovery began in 2010. We're in one of the longest recovery periods in history.
But not everyone is feeling it, and that's part of what propelled Donald Trump to the White House.
Exit polling from the New York Times found 83% of Democrats say the economy is doing excellent, and about the same portion of Republicans said it was doing poorly. $10 billion.
That's what Donald Trump's lawyer said the president-elect's business is worth in an interview with Politico this week.
The Trump Organization is privately held, and stop us if you've heard this one before, Trump isn't releasing his tax returns, so it's tough to know what his assets are actually worth.
At any rate, critics are worried Trump's business is a multi-billion dollar conflict of interest.
Traditionally, presidents' investments are managed by a third-party blind trust. In this case, Trump has said his three eldest children will manage the Trump Organization.
45%.
That's how much shares of Corrections Corporation of America jumped Wednesday.
Private prison stocks surged on the news of Donald Trump's election. They're real estate companies, and Trump has supported privatization of government services.
The rally got Corrections Corp pretty close to its August share price, which tanked after the Obama administration announced it would phase out private prisons.
Now that we're a few days out from the results of the election, it is time to do what we do best, what I talked about at the top of the show, dig into policy. And to be clear, there's a lot we don't know yet, but there are things that we do. So to start off our discussion of Donald Trump's presidency, we bring in our own Washington bureau chief, Andrea Seabrook. Hi, Andrea.
Hi.
So you have been saying really this entire election season that this is about insiders versus outsiders. And you know, if we think about this election, there's certainly a strong argument to be made that the results bore that out. What is your post-election take on this insider-outsider dynamic?
I think that Donald Trump won in large part because he tapped into this deep feeling of loss or potential loss of standing in the economy and in our culture in general, but definitely in the economy, among people who live in former industrial states of the United States, basically what we call the Rust Belt. But it's more than that. It's more than just Trump appealing to those people. The Democratic Party also lost this election because it didn't. The Democratic Party had the chance to appeal to those people. And I think as much as Donald Trump won because he appealed to disaffected Americans, economically disaffected especially, Hillary Clinton lost because she didn't appeal to those same people.
And we can't ignore race in this. Even if you look at the income breakdown brackets, it certainly breaks down by race.
That is absolutely true. You can't talk about who voted for whom without looking at that, because while it's absolutely not true, of course, that all white people voted for Trump, it is true the other way around, that almost all of the people who voted for Trump were white. Or are white. And what is striking about that, I mean, it's very common for a presidential candidate to appeal to certain groups of people. Usually it's a cross-section of race, class, you know, location, that sort of thing. In this case, the people who voted for Trump spanned across educational and economic divides. People who made less than $20,000 a year, people who made more than $200,000. People who have no, you know, haven't finished high school, people who have PhDs. The electorate that voted for Trump, the demographics there are striking because the one thing that brings them together is their race.
I want to shift to governing, because governing in many ways and putting together a transition team, a cabinet, all of those things, that's an insidery move. So
yeah.
Let's say you are Donald Trump and you don't have the cabinet in waiting that I think a lot of folks thought the Clinton campaign has. How do you do that? Does that mean you do tap old party hands? You do tap lobbyists? And if you do that, how do you not alienate all the people who voted for you?
The thing is, Lizzie, I can't say strong enough how different this election and this incoming administration is from the way Washington has worked for decades, if not a century. I mean, I have never seen, no one has seen in a century, a presidential candidate less affiliated with his own party or his stated party, less beholden to that party, with fewer ties to the lobbyists and thinkers of that party. And so a lot of those people kind of eschewed his candidacy in the first place. We don't know who's going to want to work for him and who he's going to want to work for him.
So let's talk about some of his promises. Let's play our first clip, which focuses on trade and jobs.
I'll bring back our jobs from China, from Mexico, from Japan, from so many places. I'll bring back our jobs and I'll bring back our money.
Okay, Andrea. Can that happen?
Well, no. I mean, you know, if what he means is that we're going to bring back the jobs that went to those places, it is unlikely to the point of impossible that those jobs will come back. And there are a lot of reasons for that. One, manufacturing has changed drastically. If those jobs, if the manufacturing processes that used to be here, say textile, steel, pick an industry that used to be here were to come back, they would not be performed by people. There would be a decimation of the number of jobs in those industries in the first place. They already are. If what he is saying is that we will bring jobs, not bring back those jobs, but bring jobs, well, then there are a lot of opportunities for that. But it takes a kind of commitment to social policy that we haven't necessarily seen. You can lay down tariffs on other countries importing things here and hope that that means that American businesses will recreate industry here. But like I said, that doesn't necessarily create jobs, and it's likely to start a trade war. You know, it is much more likely that what we will see if the incoming Trump administration really gets serious about creating jobs for people is, you know, a much higher commitment to retraining, to sort of, you know, figuring out what there is now and how people can get into those jobs. you just can't, you can't go back 50 years.
Essentially, all of our recent presidents have increased executive power. We have heard a lot from the president-elect about executive orders. I want to play that clip.
We're going to eliminate every unconstitutional executive order and restore the rule of law to our land.
I'm curious how that plays out once he assumes the presidency. What do you think we can expect to see on that front?
Well, I think there are a few things you can count on Trump vacating as soon as he comes in. Climate change agreements, you know, on EPA regulations. Some trade executive orders are available for that. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP negotiations. There are some healthcare orders that support Obamacare that aren't actually in the legislation that he can repeal immediately. Deferred action for what President Obama calls, you know, the dreamers. These are the children of undocumented immigrants who are themselves undocumented, who get deferred action on their immigration status. I mean, these are things that you can pretty much count on Donald Trump at least taking a very critical eye to, if not completely vacating the moment he gets in. But let's talk about the root cause here. The reason that so much is done these days by the executive branch, both in executive orders and, frankly, regulations coming from executive branch agencies, is because the Congress itself has been deadlocked, with a few small exceptions, for, you know, a couple of decades. And whenever you have like a vacuum of power like that, where, you know, people can't respond, Congress can't respond out of deadlock to a, you know, a, something facing the United States, then the executive branch is able to come in and put in an executive order that, because of the deadlock, Congress can't either supplant or, you know, figure out a way around. The thing that's interesting to me with Donald Trump coming in and vacating a lot of executive orders is that he will also have, ostensibly, a stronger Congress, because Republicans are in control of both the House and the Senate. And with a Republican president, that could change things.
Does that mean, since Congress controls the purse strings, that they are likely to fund some other parts of his agenda, a wall, say, on the border with Mexico, or significant infrastructure spending?
I think infrastructure is a place where we can expect to see real movement. And Donald Trump is coming in at the same time saying, we're going to stimulate, you know, the economy with all of this infrastructure, create new jobs and everything, but also we're going to cut taxes. And the problem he's going to have is that the moment you say my priority is to cut corporate taxes and the middle class income tax and so on and so forth, you start draining the treasury of your ability to actually invest in those things. So, you know, the great horse trade will begin and has already begun, I promise you.
Andrea Seabrook, our Washington Bureau Chief, thank you so much.
It is a pleasure, Lizzie.
Andrea talk about some potential Trump policies, and she mentioned one area we're going to really dive into now: international trade and jobs.
I'm going to tell our NAFTA partners that I intend to immediately renegotiate the terms of that agreement to get a better deal by a lot, not just a little, by a lot for our workers.
We're losing $500 billion in trade with China. Who the hell cares if there's a trade war? Trade war.
We're going to get Apple to start building their damn computers and things in this country instead of in other countries.
To talk us through all of this, we turn to our Washington correspondent, Nancy Marshall-Genzer. Thanks for joining us.
Hello.
We heard a number of clips of the president-elect talking about trade deals, talking about ripping them up. What could trade deals potentially look like under President Trump if he keeps his promises?
Right. I mean, you heard him say he's going to withdraw from NAFTA and rip it up. He also says he's going to withdraw from negotiations over the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is a trade deal we've been negotiating with Pacific Rim countries. So, yeah, he can definitely rip up these trade agreements. But the question is, would that lead to a trade war? Donald Trump says that's not a big deal, but other people say it really is. And one of those people is Chad Bown. He's with the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
Ripping up a trade agreement, we can't do that unilaterally. That means the trading partner gets to rip up the trade agreement too, and they get to start over. And if we refuse to import from them, they will quite clearly refuse to import from us. And so that means everybody in the United States that works for a company that produces something, a good or a service, that exports it to that trading partner is also going to suffer.
So none of these things that Donald Trump is talking about can be done without having some kind of a reaction from our trading partners, right? Whether it's a trade war or other negative consequences. Another thing that Trump has talked about is he says he's going to direct the Secretary of the Treasury to label China a currency manipulator. And there are ramifications there, too, because the idea is China is keeping its currency really low. That makes its exports really cheap. And the U.S. says, hey, that's not fair. But the thing is, even if we said, hey, China, you're a currency manipulator, and we raise tariffs on Chinese exports, sure, factories might leave China, but would they come to the U.S.? I asked Chad Bown about that.
If we think about the goods that we currently buy from China, so, you know, say the iPhone, you know, if we decided, as Mr. Trump has proposed, to threaten to impose a 45% tariff on imports coming in from China, yes, that may make it so that nobody wants to produce their electronic good in China and send it to the United States, but they wouldn't necessarily bring it back to the United States, that production. They might move it to Vietnam or Korea or Japan or, you know, one of dozens of other countries out there that potentially have lower costs of production for these types of manufactured goods than are possible in the United States.
And Lizzie, you know, even if those factories did move back to the U.S., there's no guarantee they would be in the Rust Belt. Maybe they would go to Alabama or Arkansas. There's no guarantee they'd go to Pennsylvania or Michigan.
Well, so a couple of things I want to point out here. We heard earlier in those clips an assertion of a $500 billion trade deficit. It is actually, for the first 10 months of this year, at $208 billion between the U.S. and China. And we should also note that the yuan, the Chinese currency, has actually been rising as opposed to depreciating. But when we look at all of these things in total, you mentioned the Rust Belt. We talked a bit about manufacturing jobs with Andrea Seabrook earlier in the show. So I guess one of the questions, since Andrea has noted how difficult it would be to bring back the kind of factory jobs of the 50s and 60s, how does President-elect Trump then square his promises to the Rust Belt with economic reality?
That would be really difficult, if not impossible. I mean, look, you know, we can't bring back 1950s, 1960s manufacturing. We're not going to have that kind of economy again. And that's what I think a lot of Trump voters want and what they expect from him. I talked to one guy, his name is Joe Del Signor. He's in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, big steel town, big coal town. He says, okay, we can't go back to the way it was 50, 60 years ago, but he does expect a big resurgence in the coal mines. We'll see if that happens. But the fact is that people need to retrain for today's information economy. And I asked Chad Bown if that's possible.
We don't currently have the programs in place in the United States to make it possible. And I think that's the big question. Can a President Trump reimagine the labor market adjustment policies, the education policies, to help those workers make that adjustment? And I think that's the key question. It's going to be really impossible to go back to the 1960s. So can he help these folks transition into the 21st century economy?
Nancy, when you spoke to the gentleman in Johnstown or in other places, did they think he could help them do that?
it's funny, the people that I talked to weren't really focused on the information economy so much. They were focused more on the steel factories, the coal mines, and also the trains that don't run through town anymore. There used to be trains, you know, carrying steel and coal out of Johnstown constantly, and that's not happening anymore. I did talk to a professor named Alan Meltzer at Carnegie Mellon University, which, of course, is right there in Pittsburgh, another big steel town. And he did talk more about the information economy. He said, look, we've got high-tech companies moving to Pittsburgh, healthcare companies, and they are going to need workers. But he said so far, you know, government retraining programs just haven't worked. And the only people who've gotten jobs out of them are the trainers themselves. So clearly we've got to find some way to get these workers into the information economy because, like I said, we're not going back 50, 60 years.
Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer. Thank you.
You're welcome.
There's more Marketplace Weekend just ahead. Healthcare is more than 17% of our economy. And of course, the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, came up a lot in this election. President-elect Trump has promised to repeal it, and Republicans in the House and Senate would also like to do that. So, is the ACA toast? From the Health Desk at WHYY, our reporter Dan Gorenstein is here to help answer that question. Hi, Dan.
Hey, Lizzie.
So, we have heard the mantra of repeal and replace, or repeal and reform. Do we know at this point what the future of the Affordable Care Act looks like right now?
No. Simply, you know, I mean, honestly, I think there have been all kinds of variations of if somebody tells you they know what to expect, they're lying. The best we can go on really is a plan that was introduced by Speaker Ryan that ultimately passed the House and the Senate, ultimately vetoed by President Obama. But that's really sort of a starting point in the conversation.
Well, what is in Speaker Paul Ryan's plan, if we were to say that may be the jumping-off point for a Trump presidency healthcare plan?
Without getting too deep into the details, one thing that I've learned in the past couple of days is that a lot of the ideas in the Affordable Care Act are similar to the ideas in the Ryan plan. So the Ryan plan would most likely keep exchanges. The subsidies, though, would be skimpier. You know, it's an open question as to whether or not Medicaid expansion would continue or in what form. So if you, right now, today, you have Medicaid because you are part of that expanded population, you may have it, you may not. I think those are key things. I think open questions here, Lizzie, and these are really important, are what would happen to the provision in the Affordable Care Act that says children up to age 26 can stay on their parents' health plans. And then another really important one, particularly if you have a pre-existing health condition, is right now insurers have to take your business if you want. In the past, before the Affordable Care Act, if you had a pre-existing condition, insurers could say, you know what, you're going to be sick, you're going to be expensive, forget it, I don't want to do business with you. Today, under the ACA, they have to do business with you. We don't know what's going to happen with that provision going forward under a Paul Ryan plan, although it does discuss it.
You know, those are two things that you mentioned that are extremely popular with consumers. And when we think about the Affordable Care Act, a lot of people focus on the healthcare marketplaces. We should note most Americans still get their insurance from their work or from something like Medicare or Medicaid. So when we think about what a reform, repeal, whatever of the ACA could look like, can we know what this means for consumers?
So, you know, there are 22 million people, approximately 20-some million people, who now have insurance coverage thanks to the Affordable Care Act. Potentially, some of the benefits they enjoy right now under the Affordable Care Act could go away. I've talked to a couple of people, conservative health policy types, who've said, you know, there are some people who are currently enjoying benefits that probably will not have those benefits. We don't know what to expect, and there's all kinds of debate. But if you're sick today, Lizzie, you have to be paying attention very closely.
Some of these things require congressional authorization. Are there things that President Trump could do on day one without Congress?
Yes. A lot of what President Obama has done with the Affordable Care Act, because he hasn't gotten much cooperation from Congress, has been done through the executive branch. One of those things is funding a certain type of subsidy for some people who are buying insurance on the exchanges. Donald Trump, day one, could go in and cut those subsidies. That would make it harder for people to afford their insurance, and that would perhaps likely end up encouraging more insurers to pull out of selling insurance on the marketplaces. But it seems like a Trump administration is not just going to do the repeal. There's also going to be a replace element. So I think Trump is in a difficult position here where there's the campaign rhetoric, you know, repeal and replace day one, with the responsibility of governing and knowing that there are millions of people out there who have benefits. And do you really want to cut them off at the knees? I think that, too, is an open question.
We are having this conversation in the period of time known as open enrollment. That is when people, you know, sign up for their health care plans. And so, yes, there's a lot we can't know on a policy level yet. But are there any things we can glean from how this is affecting open enrollment right now?
Great. Yes, we can. You know, Health and Human Services Secretary Burwell tweeted that November 9th was the single biggest day of enrollment she's ever seen in the history of the Affordable Care Act. So really, the only way to read this is, you know, a lot of people have been criticizing the Affordable Care Act because people have not signed up. And that's part of why we've seen these premiums increase this year. And then Donald Trump gets elected and then you have a historic boom. I mean, Lizzie, you know, connect the dots.
Dan Gorenstein, our healthcare reporter. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Lizzie.
We just heard how the Affordable Care Act might change under a Trump presidency. One part of the ACA is women's health. Right now, women in the U.S. have access to birth control and other preventative care without co-pays or deductibles from their insurance companies. Plus, there is the question of Planned Parenthood and its funding. Sarah Cliff is a senior editor at Vox, and she writes primarily about healthcare. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You know, we've just been talking about the Affordable Care Act with our healthcare correspondent, and I guess since we're breaking down this subset of it, what would repealing the ACA do to and for women's health?
So there could be a lot of changes. One of the ones that comes to mind immediately is a change to the birth control mandate. So since 2012, the ACA has mandated that everybody, not just people on the marketplaces, everybody have access to no-cost-sharing contraceptives. You can get an IUD at no cost, get birth control pills at no cost. That requirement has been quite popular. Lots of women have used it. It is one of the best-liked parts of the Affordable Care Act, and that is something that could very easily be on the chopping block with repeal.
And my understanding is, and tell me how this works, that's not something that the president-elect would have to go to Congress for.
Yeah, it's kind of in a weird spot because of some regulatory factors. But the contraceptive mandate in Obamacare, it isn't actually part of the law. The law just says insurance companies have to cover preventative health benefits for women. It's up to the administration to decide what counts as a preventative health benefit. The Trump administration, day one, if they want, they can go in, they can write new regulations, scratch birth control off the list, and that takes effect pretty immediately. So Congress does not have to do anything as they would to repeal most other parts of the Affordable Care Act.
So let's say that happens. What would that mean for women economically?
It would mean spending a lot more money on contraceptives. And this would matter a lot for women who are getting birth control pills every month, who would probably face a $5, $10 copay depending on their insurance, especially for long-acting reversible birth controls, which can be quite expensive, like IUDs. Insurance companies, if they want, they can charge that all out of pocket, which could be up to $500, which is why you might have seen some articles flying around the internet this week saying, get your IUDs now before January and Trump comes into office, which I initially thought were quite alarmist. And, you know, I didn't realize it was so different from the rest of the ACA, but it really does seem like this is something that could go away very quickly. And it would mean for women spending more on contraceptives. would probably mean more unintended pregnancies, too. The best research we have suggests when you have less access to birth control, you have more women getting pregnant unexpectedly.
One very controversial topic that we're going to dive into is Planned Parenthood. Trump campaigned, among other things, on a promise to defund Planned Parenthood. And this is a very thorny question, both in terms of policy, but also in terms of the economics of how something like Planned Parenthood works. So I would like you to walk us through what it means if a Trump administration says no federal money for Planned Parenthood whatsoever.
So you would probably see a lot less Planned Parenthoods is the kind of upshot of it. Planned Parenthood gets a lot of money from the federal government right now. And this is not for the abortion. There are federal regulations that do not allow the government to spend money on abortions. This is for the work they do.
Although we should say that people who are anti-abortion would say that money is fungible.
Sure. Yeah. So federal money can go to a clinic that provides abortions. Usually it's grants to increase screenings for cancer, to provide birth control to low-income women, to give them reproductive health counseling. It is true that it does go to abortion clinics. It goes to clinics like Planned Parenthood. And that is why you've seen this push over the past few years to defund Planned Parenthood, that anti-abortion advocates will argue, well, they couldn't be in the abortion business if they weren't getting all these federal grants. And they do seem to be right that what you would expect is a lot of these Planned Parenthood clinics would likely shut down. There doesn't seem to be right now the infrastructure for other clinics to come in and take their place. You'd see a lot less Planned Parenthood clinics and not other clinics able to step up and fill that gap they would leave behind.
Yeah, I guess that's sort of the follow-on question where folks who say there should not be government money for Planned Parenthood have also said, well, private businesses would come in and fill that gap. Private clinics would. Is there any evidence to support that private clinics would do that?
There isn't at the moment. The best evidence we have comes from Texas, which did defund Planned Parenthood clinics in 2013. So you see research coming out of the University of Texas where high-income women are able to get their services elsewhere, where they go to a different doctor, they're able to find something. Low-income women, they just get less health care. It does not seem to be the case that they just go to another provider. There's some other interesting research looking at states in the Midwest where reproductive health clinics closed. And again, they found that women who became further from a clinic, they just got less health care. And it kind of makes sense when you think about it, that if you have a reproductive health clinic maybe 3-5 miles away, maybe you'll go get your cervical cancer screening. It's not that much work. But if you're going to have to drive 25-50 miles, like the preventative services they're providing are, you know, for something that might or might not happen. So you might just say, you know what, it's not worth the work to get that screening. So the best research we have, it's admittedly a pretty small body of research. It does not suggest that other clinics step in to fill the place when Planned Parenthood goes away.
Sarah Cliff, senior editor at Vox, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're going to end this show with a break from politics and play you this week's edition of the Marketplace Quiz. That's when we ask actors, musicians, writers, and other people in the spotlight to share their stories about work, money, and the lessons they've learned along the way. This week, we've got the band Sleigh Bells.
Hey, this is Derek Miller.
And this is Alexis Krauss, and we are Sleigh Bells.
Alexis, what is something you bought that you now completely regret buying?
I tend to buy clothes that I never wear, but I have this one
you're in the nude.
Right, constantly. No, but I actually have this one very vivid memory. I don't think it was purchased with my own money because I was probably about 9, but do you remember moon shoes?
The trampoline. Yeah, those were terrible.
I vividly remember having those and just thinking they were awful and realizing that it was a very poor purchase on behalf of myself.
I want
to
apologize to Moon Shoes Inc.
They didn't work.
Are they still in business?
Probably not. They were terrible, so don't buy Moon Shoes.
Okay. Sorry, Moon Shoes.
Derek, what was your first job?
I was a bag boy, a grocery dude at public supermarkets, and I held that job for about 6 weeks. And within 3 days, I knew who the good tippers were, you know, who was cheap. And I kind of bullied my way into, like, I'd see, you know, a lady come in with, like, or, you know, she'd pull up the register with, like, two carts, and there'd be somebody else there to bag, and I'd be like, you know, get out of here. I feel ashamed.
Bag hustle.
I feel ashamed to admit that right now. And I still, at least, that's a good thing that I feel guilty about that, at least. And, yeah, I got fired because I joined a hardcore band and didn't show up. Anyway, Publix, thank you.
That's a quality grocery store right there.
Great subs. I love Publix. Alexis, do you remember the first time you were paid to perform? This would have been a long time ago, like way pre-Sleigh Bells.
Yeah. I mean, it depends on what type of performance. Like, I was in a Nickelodeon magazine commercial and I winked at the camera. So if that counts as a performance, then I was about 10 years old. It was really hard to do.
And that's on the internet as well.
It is.
So please look.
Thank you, internet.
Yeah.
Derek, in a next life, what would your career be?
Head coach of an NBA team, without question.
You'd make a great coach.
Thank you. I'd like to think so. Because, yeah, I like to encourage people, and I don't necessarily need the spotlight, or actually prefer not to be in it at all. So, yeah, I want to coach the Miami Heat.
And you'd have, like, good coach dances that would get your team really excited.
Yeah, I have a really good coach dance, whatever that is. I don't know. I don't think I would have a dance. Pat Riley doesn't have a dance.
Okay.
So, Alexis, what is your most prized possession?
If creatures with beating hearts are considered possessions, which I think they are because I did purchase her, it would be my dog, my bull terrier, Rizla.
Yeah.
She's the love of my life.
Yeah, Rizla is a special creature. She comes on tour with us. And yeah, I don't know.
But if it wasn't a dog, it would probably be my my milk foamer, my latte foamer.
Oh.
I just love that thing so much.
I was trying to imagine what a milk foamer was, because I don't drink coffee, so.
I brought it on the tour bus. I love it that much. What is something everyone should own, no matter the cost?
Band-Aids.
Probably a good pair of headphones. That's what I would think you would say.
I'm going to go with Band-Aids.
You're such an audiophile. No, you can go with Band-Aids.
Yeah. I was thinking, I was going to try to say something sarcastic, but no, I mean, if you like cut your arm open or something, or like stub your toe, you got a Band-Aid, you're good.
Yeah, well, Band-Aids are notoriously extremely expensive, so it's a really good investment.
Not everybody has $5 sitting around.
So this is true.
I'm serious. So, Alexis, what advice do you wish somebody gave you before you started your career?
I guess for me, it always kind of comes back to just sort of self-confidence and standing up for myself and just sort of not taking criticism that was sort of unsolicited or came from the press too seriously. I think, I don't want to say that I was damaged by anything in the beginning, but I think that hit me hard and was overwhelming at first, and I've developed a much thicker skin and become a much more confident, self-assured person. So I think just kind of being a little tougher about things like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I probably should have just taken much better care of myself for the first couple of years. I was going to say that I think I got that advice a lot, but probably ignored it. So I probably, I wish I had taken that advice, but I'm cool.
Sleigh Bells album, Jessica Rabbit, is out now. And that's our show for this week. Next week, we will get into more policy. We know there's still lots to talk about. Taxes, regulation, and more. We're also thinking about heading home for the holidays. So we'd like to know if you've managed ways to make it affordable and bearable. Come tell us. Visit marketplace.org, our Facebook page, or call us 1-800-648-5114. And yes, your voice might be featured on the air. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Haley Hirschman and Eliza Mills, with help this week from Cerise Castle. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer. Charlton Thorpe is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Satara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer. Deborah Clark is our vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.